Glad to be here this afternoon. I've been in the addiction counseling profession since 1973, and I've seen a lot of changes go on over the years since I started in this business, and hopefully we'll be able to blend a lot of that information into what I have to say to you today. This topic of verbal abuse is something that I was introduced to through a lady named Patricia Evans in her textbook, The Verbally Abusive Relationship. If you haven't read it, I would encourage all of you to read it. It's got a slant to it that particularly from a woman's perspective, or only or solely from a woman's perspective. In the home study course that I do on it, I add the male's perspective, when the male is the victim of verbal abuse. But her book certainly is slanted towards when the female is the victim of that particular form of abuse. And why I wanted to give a talk on this topic, or why I like this topic, is that I think that it's not addressed very much, or at least I was an offender. I didn't address it. I never said, how are you affected by what people said to you? I very often said, how are you affected by what people did to you? But I never put much emphasis into what people said to you. And so this is all about the hurts and pains that are caused in the individual's life simply by what is said to someone. I bought into the belief years ago the idea that was put out there a long time ago, that sticks and stones won't break my bones and words will never harm me. And so I certainly went along with that idea, although in my first recovery issues, my own life, I was a victim of verbal abuse by my father. Was talked to in many ways that didn't support who I was as a human being, and have worked for a long time recovering from that, and I don't know why I never bothered to ask any of my clients in 20-some-odd years how they were affected by what someone said to them. It just went over my head for a long time. Just like a lot of things in my early training, I was focused on just looking at certain aspects in recovery and didn't pay much attention to other aspects or issues. And so this text has certainly allowed me to be, I think, far more effective than I had been in the past. Let me say, on this front row here, I didn't have enough handouts for the front row, and I thought this would be like church and no one would sit in the front row. and the back row would take it over. But there are handouts in the back, and if you leave without getting the white handout, give me your business card. Give me your business card and put verbal abuse on the back of the card, and I'll mail you the handout. I'm glad to do that for you. So as a clinician in this profession, I wanted to find out more effective ways to provide health and recovery to the clients that come to see me. And I think also some of the other influence in my creating the course and this talk and doing the work on verbal abuse had to do with the influence that a man named John James, I don't know if he's presenting here this time, but he's presented here in the past doing grief recovery work, the impact that he had on me about how powerful and really how relatively easy it is to say goodbye to pain of the past. I'm a believer now, for a long time I wasn't, that we can get over painful events very quickly. It doesn't take a lifetime to get over anything. It didn't take a lifetime for us to be affected, and so it doesn't take a lifetime for us to heal. And I've seen that particularly in working with victims of verbal abuse, when they get one very simple concept, that they did absolutely nothing to cause the abuse. If the abuser has a thought that says, what did I do to cause this abuse, at that moment they have bought into the abuse. They are into that cycle of thinking that will continue to destroy them, because they allow that idea in. So the simple bit of recovery, and we can go home at this point, if you can get your clients to understand that they did absolutely nothing to cause the abuse, that will produce in and of itself, when they really buy that concept and idea, that will cause them at that point to heal from that abuse. Because part of the effects of verbal abuse is to believe that there's something wrong with me. Create negative, self-defeating core beliefs that support the thought process that allows them to stay stuck in a relationship where verbal abuse is a part of that dynamic. And so if people will accept that they did nothing to cause the abuse. It wasn't what they said, it wasn't what they didn't say, it wasn't what they did, and it wasn't what they didn't do. None of those things had anything to do with the verbal abuse. According to Patricia Evans, and then also working with clients, I began to find out that that was exactly the truth. That people who are victims of verbal abuse come from an understanding or a mindset that's really seeking and searching for mutuality and co-creation. How can I work it out here in this relationship? Now we're going to take this back to childhood for a minute. There's some more chairs and things up here if y'all want to come up here. Right over here, back there. In childhood, what I know about childhood development is that children are very willing participants in their lives. And if they do something that's wrong or bad, a couple of seats over here, and someone discounts them or harms them or blames them for something, the child is very quick to take it on. And from a child's perspective, they want power and control. So they develop a thought process that says, what did I do to cause this? Now think about it for a minute. There's power in that thought process. If you're just a little tyke, a little kid, and you don't have any power and control, and someone is saying or doing something to you, and you don't know how you can stop that from happening, and they may be telling you directly or indirectly that you did something to cause that, then if the child believes in their own brain that I must have done something to cause this, then the power of that thought is if I change what I'm doing, thinking, saying, acting, and reacting, then I can stop this abuse from occurring. I can stop it from happening. So the child is really coming from a place of mutuality. Hey, how can we work it out? How can we make this thing work? You know, it doesn't have to be rough. Let's work this thing out. So the child is coming from that perspective. The victim of verbal abuse also comes from that perspective. And Patricia Evans, she calls that coming from a reality base of reality one base, which is mutuality and co-creation. How can I work this relationship out? What is it that I'm doing? Now, it's important to understand this dynamic because, remember what I said earlier, that we've got to work with the victim of verbal abuse to help them understand that their abuse has nothing to do with what they say or do. At a level, this is going against their belief system and how they put life together. Their reality base is out of mutuality and co-creation, like I said. And in that reality base, there's going to be an automatic cloth that shows up. If we're going to be mutual in a relationship, that means that if you do something or if there's a negative impact or even a positive impact on you and you want to have mutuality in the relationship, then you're going to take that back. And if you have healthy boundaries, you kind of put it up on your shoulder and notice it, what did I do to cause this? And then if you didn't do anything, you'll simply let that go. If you did do something, then you'll alter, change, correct, and then you can have the kind of relationship that you say you want to have with the person that you're in a relationship with. But in verbal abuse, that is the issue. The mindset of the perpetrator is about power and control. They will have power and control at all costs. And nothing that the victim does will take that idea away from the perpetrator because that's their perspective. That's how they see the world.
Yes. Do you see that in women as well as men? They're looking for power and control also during the perpetrator?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think that verbal abuse is very democratic. It's not sexist at all. It doesn't particularly care. This whole thing of sexism and racism and all that other stuff is something that human beings created later on in life. Yes?
Those that were wanting to attend Tom Sable's class, he finally showed up, so if there's anybody in here that wants to go
there. Okay. Right. So we've got this mindset working from the perpetrator's standpoint of wanting to have, and that's really how they see the world, is having power and control over. And if I can say something to you, and if I can get you to do what I want you to do, which is obey, which is to do exactly what I tell you to do, or really it's not either of those things. It's about just controlling so that I can have the experience of controlling. See, I don't care if you give me salad. I don't care if you give me potatoes. I don't care about that. I want to control. That's what I want. That's the mindset of the perpetrator of verbal abuse. And so you've got the perpetrator who's involved with attempting to, and at all costs, demanding and requiring of their victim that they will control them. They will control them at all costs. And that's what they're about. And the issue with this abuse is that there is no resolution possible. I don't know if you've ever been, if you've ever had the experience of being in a relationship with someone that is in fact verbally abusive, and you attempt to get some kind of resolution out of that relationship. Ladies, there's some chairs over here. There's a couple people left. Okay, all right. And so you attempt to gain or to get some kind of resolution. The perpetrator of verbal abuse will not allow that to happen. There will be no closure. And that's what's crazy about it. And it's not that people talk harshly to each other. Those might be verbally abusive situations and incidences where we might regret, oh my God, I wish I hadn't said that to you. That would be someone that is really also looking for mutuality and co-creation. And they get upset, they get hot, they lose themselves for a minute and say or do something that they regret later on down the line. Well, they have regret going for them, and they're going to be willing to find some way to gain some kind of resolution or closure with you. So not everyone that talks to us in a mean way is a verbally abusive, is a perpetrator of verbal abuse. They might be verbally abusive from time to time, but they're looking for and they're wanting to have some kind of closure and resolution. But the perpetrator of verbal abuse will not do that. They will not allow for closure to happen. If there's closure, then that means that we can close the door on the whole thing and we can't bring that one up anymore. That means that in that moment of closure of me, let's say the perpetrator, acknowledging that I have said or done something to you that was hurtful, the perpetrator must become vulnerable at that point. And we all know at the point of vulnerability, we can't have power and control. That means there's going to be some fluidity. That means there's going to be some way of working out. There's going to be some idea of resolution that's going to occur at that point. So the perpetrator will not allow that to happen. If they allow that to happen, they're going to have to take a look at their own hurts and pains and sorrows. And guess what? If they're doing that, they're not in control. Someone or something else is in control, and they're not going to allow that to happen. That's why the people that come into treatment generally are the victims of verbal abuse, and very seldom are the first people in treatment the perpetrators of verbal abuse. It's the victims that are seeming to be going crazy. It's very crazy-making to be in a relationship with someone that's verbally abusive. You're looking for resolution. You didn't know that you made the wrong kind of salad. You didn't know that you woke up on the wrong side of the bed. You didn't know that the way you spoke was a problem for them. You didn't know that the look that you gave them was demeaning. You didn't know that asking a simple question to ascertain very specific information was stupid on your part. You didn't know that. You didn't know that. You thought you were just looking for some information. You thought that just because they said that they didn't care what they had for dinner, that they meant what they said. You didn't know that it was the kind of clothing that you were wearing that was really offensive to them. You didn't know that it was the tone of voice that was offensive to them. You didn't know that. They didn't give you any information about that. They didn't apprise you of any of these facts, except when you did what you've done, goodness, for 23 years now you've been doing that same thing, and boom, then there it is. Now it's not okay. And whereas the other crazy-making part of this is that you see the perpetrator in the family. And the family has one perspective. And this perspective is guarded from the rest of the world. And then you have this perspective out here. This is the one the world sees. And you know what? This guy's a good old Joe. This guy's everybody's friend. Everybody loves and respects the perpetrator in most situations. And it's a completely different perspective between this person that the world sees and this person back here in the protection of the family that they see, that they're involved with, that they know about. Worked with a woman about a year and a half ago. She came in and she'd been a bride for about 9 months. And she was really upset. She didn't know what was going on. She was a fairly high-powered sales professional in the hotel business and could wield the power with the best of them with all of her employees. But when she got married, and prior to marriage, everything was just hunky-dory and fine in the relationship. But when she got married and started to be with her husband on a regular basis, they'd already lived together, but what I mean is, when they got married and started to live with her husband on a regular basis in marriage, you see, there's a difference between living with someone unmarried and living with someone married. You're at the same physical address, but there's this magical thing called marriage that happens that changes and shifts what that relationship means. Well, that may be part of it, but if that is more about how they perceived or how they experienced their parents being married, what they experienced when they were growing up in that kind of environment, when they observed mom and dad being in a relationship. I've seen the same phenomena of where the marriage or the relationship is just fine prior to marriage. But on the night of the honeymoon or very shortly thereafter, for survivors of physical abuse, sexual abuse and incest, and verbal abuse, the abuse is that the marriage triggers past memories in the perpetrator and in the victim. And then everything is different on the night of the honeymoon. The verbal abuse in her marriage didn't begin until they were married. Up until then, it was an absolutely marvelous relationship. She thought she'd found the guy that rides that white horse. And found out that he was the other end of the horse. after they got married. And you know what? She was very confused. She came in saying, "What did I do?" See, this is an honest question for survivor, for people that are victims of verbal abuse. You'll hear that question from them a lot. What did I do? I can't for the life of me figure out what I did, what I said, what I didn't say in order to cause. Remember the child again? Always wanting to have some kind of control over an uncontrollable or a crazy-making situation. What did I do to cause this? Remember mutuality and co-creation. The mindset of the victim. I want to resolve this. If I did anything to cause this, hey, I want to stop that because I want a nice relationship. And so already buying into, if I did something, then I cannot do that and I can have a relationship that works for me. Not understanding that the issue in verbal abuse is the verbal abuse. That's the issue. The power and control consistently comes from no possibility of resolution. It cannot occur. The perpetrator will not allow for resolution to happen. Remember, if there is resolution, then that means that the perpetrator must acknowledge that they did something. The perpetrator must acknowledge their own vulnerability. The perpetrator must acknowledge their own feelings and the impact that they have on someone else's life. And if they're coming from power and control, from that mindset, from that way of thinking, from that way of acting, from that way of responding, from that simple way of just being, that's their beingness at that point, so locked into that mindset, just like the victim is so locked into the mindset of mutuality and co-creation, that mindset blinds them to seeing from another perspective, stops them from seeing from another perspective at all. And that mindset is as blinding for the victim as it is for the perpetrator. Because the perpetrator the victim is still looking for mutuality. And it's going to affect that way of thinking if he or she acknowledges that I can't get resolution from this person. That's going to be crazy making to that individual too from their perspective. Because the way they view the world is we can resolve this. And most of the time, people get into the mindset of creating resolution within the relationship. Whereas many times, if you're in relationship with someone who is verbally abusive, the resolution will only come after you leave the relationship. That the resolution in most cases is, I have to be out of here. I can't be in this relationship. The other interesting statistic, and if you're involved with spouse abuse, and if you're involved with family violence situations, all the studies that I have read point to this one fact, that in 100% of the cases where there is physical abuse, 100% of those people that are physically abused started out by being verbally abused. Now, not everyone that is verbally abusive will, in fact, physically abuse someone. But in cases where there is physical abuse, in 100% of the cases, it starts with verbal abuse. Now, why will someone stay in that? Because they want to work it out. So we've got a cycle going now. We've got a cycle. And both feeds off the other. And the sad thing is that if the perpetrator loses this one and says, this one says, I won't take this anymore, unless they're in recovery and seeking a resolution themselves, and that totally is against what they're about, then they, in fact, will simply find someone else over here to be their victim and to play victim. Likewise, if the victim gets out of that relationship and hasn't told the truth, because that's all this is about now, is telling the truth. If the victim hasn't told the truth about this relationship, they'll simply replace that one with someone else. And it's at a level that's about the whole idea of codependency, loss of sense of self. It may be what they observed in their family as the norm. It may be that they have been so brainwashed in that relationship because the subtleties of verbal abuse are just phenomenal. It's not like you get punched and you know you got punched. If you're sitting there having a nice dinner and your partner looks up at you and says, God, I talked to you, but you're so damn stupid. I just, you know, and then rolls their eyes and goes on and talks to somebody else. Or, that was really a stupid comment that you made. Where did you go to school? Or didn't you graduate? My God, woman, man, what's wrong with you? And they go on with the conversation. It's just a total discount of the individual. And because of mutuality and co-creation, wanting to work things out, and if they have low self-esteem, they're going to say, well, God, maybe I am stupid. You know, I really didn't get my degree. I wasn't magnum cum kumbaya. I didn't do all of those things. So really, maybe I am stupid. Or, you know, I'm not as pretty as I used to be or as handsome. Maybe, yeah, if I was only then. And they can go off with that. And that cycle is what they then create. That's the part that they play. That's the subtlety. The perpetrator comes in and says something. It's what the victim does with it that keeps them hooked into the process. They're not going to come to your office probably and say, my husband, wife, boyfriend, girlfriend, boss, employer was ragging on me the other day and I just got so confused because, you know, there was no resolution in this communication. We didn't get it together. I walked out of the office and I felt just as crazy as I went in before. He or she will probably tell you there's something wrong with me and I don't know what it is. And if we don't know what's going on, we might believe there is something wrong with them too. That's the other thing, characteristic you'll find with victims of verbal abuse. They've been going to therapy for a long time. They've been reading self-help books out the kazoo. Oh, my thing on self-help books? I like them and I think it's great and all that. But what I find is that a lot of people have great libraries. And how many of us could start a company if we pooled our books together? We could really sell some books. We could push some products. It's that a lot of people tend to believe that if they read something, that will have some meaning in and of itself. Well, what I like to say is that if we just read a book, we're just well-educated sick people. That's all that happens. We just have a higher level of education about our pathology. But the education in and of itself is useless. It doesn't produce change. But on the other hand, we have to have education. It's a necessary component because unless someone says, this is abusive and this is healthy, and we don't have a picture of what that's like, no one's ever laid that out for us, we're not going to know the difference. We're simply not going to know the difference if we haven't been educated to that. If our experience has been our education, and our experience has showed us that people that love us treat us in demeaning ways, then that's our lesson. Also, what's interesting, if you do family of origin work with the perpetrator or with the victim of verbal abuse, you'll probably find that they have come from a system where that has been the norm, where there has been subtle put-downs, where there has been yelling, screaming, hollering, demeaning, name-calling, other forms and types of situations that put the individual down, demanding tones of voice, that look that can kill, look that controls, that tone that says, there's something wrong with you. It's not that your behavior is questionable, it's that you are questionable. like a shame-based family environment, where you grew up, on one hand, you were loved and told that you were special, and on the other hand, you might have been compared with a brother, sister, aunt, uncle, cousin, someone else, and told, in no uncertain terms, that if only you would do this, then you would be okay. But they never said that. What they said was something like, if you'll do this, then our lives will be better, then your lives will be better. There's something wrong with you. Not there's something wrong with the way you're doing it. There's something wrong with you. And so people begin to buy that. If they come from verbal abuse in the family where there is no resolution, that's probably going to be a setup for them also being a perpetrator to be a verbally abusive person themselves, because that's what they observed. And how many of you went to school here? This would mean that you did, and this would mean that you didn't. Two of you, okay? A couple of you went to school. School. Went to school. Okay, a couple of you went to school. Okay. Some of you did, some of you didn't. Alright. How many of you learned that one and one was two when you were going to school? This would mean that you did, this would mean that you didn't. Okay. Good. Alright, we're up on it. Good. Yeah, okay. Yeah. Alright. So, those of you that went to school and learned that one and one is two, I would submit that if I were to come up here as someone in authority, and of course I am because of all these little alphabets that I have behind my name, so of course I have authority and power and all of those things. Now I'm going to tell you this truth. I've done considerable research and I now have found out that one and one is three. Now how many of you are going to buy what I'm selling? I've got the credentials. I'm an educator, international presenter, known all over the world. I've got videotapes. I've got paper to prove it. I've got degrees on the wall, and I really know that one and one is three. Now that I've done all those proof statements, how many of you are going to buy what I'm selling, even though I've got the credentials to sell it? One? Okay. Well, that's in the minority, and that's usually the way that it is. See, when our clients come to us, they have been taught for years that you're worthless, that there's something wrong with you, that if only you would do it differently, then you would be okay, that I have to keep you in line because you're really stupid, and if someone didn't keep you in line, there's no telling what would happen to you. And my God, really, I mean, you might have a good job, but you know what? You've scammed all those people. I know the truth about you. And this person has bought that very subtly over a long period of time. Part of it had nothing to do with their partner that is the perpetrator, so let's not blame that person totally. And none of this is about blame as far as I'm concerned. None of this is about blame. It doesn't matter what people have done to you or to me or anybody else. If we're going to blame people, then no one heals, in my opinion. I'm a major believer in absolute total forgiveness. We must forgive if we're going to heal. We must do that. But in this situation, long before we get to healing, we're looking at our influences, our one and one is twos, what we were taught, the information that was coming in when we were vulnerable, when we didn't know, when we didn't have any other influences to teach us or to combat or to question that information, or when the information came in that questioned that I'm no good, because on the other hand it was, yes, you are good. And then it was questionable. I am good, but only under certain circumstances and only during certain times am I good. Other than that, I'm not good. This is very confusing for people, particularly when they're learning about shame, which is there's something wrong with me. They didn't learn guilt, and that really is, I think, the job of the clinician is to help people learn about guilt, is that there's nothing wrong with you, but your behavior is questionable. You've got to do something about the behavior. That doesn't work. But you as a human being, regardless of your behavior, are just fine. There's nothing wrong with you. Murder, rapist, robber, a perpetrator of abuse, there's nothing wrong with you as a human being or victim of any of those things. There's something wrong with your behavior because it has a negative impact on other people.
I guess the victim is a non-person. One plus one would be one.
That's correct. That's correct. That's right. They are an object. And that's certainly the case in every time there is a victim. That the perpetrator sees themselves, and this is what I've found out about perpetrators of every type of violence, is they see themselves as a victim, even though they put themselves in a power position. They are an object, and the people that they've hurt are objects. So maybe it's zero when it comes to that. It's zero. You have no meaning or value. I have meaning and value only from what I get from you. But bottom line is, I have no meaning or value either. Particularly if in their historical perspective, they were taught that they were meaningless, that there was something wrong with them. They learned that. And so feelings or mutuality or relationship or connection can't happen in that kind of an environment. Isn't one of the things that we learn in treatment, all the huggy stuff that goes on, isn't that saying that you're okay? Or even the books, I'm okay, you're okay? Or some of them, I'm okay and you're questionable, or it depends on the author's opinion at the time. Okay? So we've got these dynamics that are going on in the individual's life that they're learning this from a long time ago. If you're interested in doing some in-depth family of origin work with people, I'd suggest you learn about genograms. Monica McGoldrick and Randy Gerson have a great book called Genograms and Family Assessment. Now, the value of seeing a genogram is that over a long period of time, two or three generations, you can get an idea from someone, from their family history, how they were taught to treat each other, how they were taught to experience each other. By looking at their behaviors, what happened, the types of addictions, the type of behaviors that those people back in the history were exhibiting. In that process, in and of itself, if you can do a good, thorough genogram on someone and put that up on paper, I've seen people that have believed that they were worthless find meaning and value in who they were once they saw themselves in the light of their system. You see, dysfunction, the only time I can call anybody's behavior dysfunctional is if I place a judgment on it from the outside. I look inside that system and I say, oh, this is dysfunctional and this is why, because I'm seeing it from this perspective and calling it dysfunctional. But how many people have you worked with who are, when you talk about their system, abuse, abandonment, neglect, any of those things, they don't have a negative or a dysfunctional value on that. They say, well, that, you know, I wasn't hit. I wasn't screamed at when I was growing up. That's just how they talked to me. Or I deserved it. Hey, it's no big deal. It's water off my back. I'm just a duck. And so they dispel, they move aside the impact that that had. So in their eyes, it wasn't dysfunctional. It wasn't abusive. That's just how fathers talk to sons, was my concept. That when I first read a book that said that a father would be there with their son to nurture him, to honor him, to help him grow, to be the man that he was attempting to become just by his physiological connection with his body, he was attempting to be a man if he was going to get through childhood, growing to be a human being, that fathers were there to love and to nurture their sons. But that wasn't my concept of father. My concept of father, normal fathers, what they did to sons was yell at them, hit them, scream at them, tell them that they would amount to be nothing, that they were worthless and no good. And why weren't they like somebody else? So that's what I learned about fathering. So as a father, that's what I taught. As a son, that's what I learned. And so until I learned that there's a difference in that, that fathering's not that, that's one and one is two, I can't do anything about that. Now back to your victim. If he or she came from a system where they were verbally abused, and most of them have come from that system, where there was discounting, where there was demeaning behavior, where there was yelling, screaming, name-calling, demeaning in some way, discounting who they were as a human being, jealous behavior going on, where there was a lot of ridicule, insulting, remarks were made, that someone in their system from time to time came along and said, this isn't the truth. They don't know what they're talking about. Come talk to me about how you feel. What they said had nothing to do with you. They were just, they're just crazy. They're just mean. That's all they are. And the individual, the victim, when they were growing up, got validation for their feelings and found someone there to help bring closure. So they know verbal abuse, but also they got a lesson that the one that is the perpetrator of verbal abuse didn't get. They found out that they could find mutuality and co-creation, that they could get closure to their hurts and pains. And so they're familiar with abuse, so that might be part of the attraction issue going on. But they got a lesson, an experiential lesson. They didn't read it in the book. It actually happened in their life. that someone significant in their life came along and supported them through their trauma, at least some of the time. At least some of the time. So they know and are familiar with abuse, but they also know and are familiar with resolution, something that the perpetrator never got when they were growing up. Or if they got it, it was so sporadic it didn't have any impact, it didn't have any imprinting in their life. It was simply something that just, it was a non-issue in their life. So these folks are learning that one and one is two. And so when your victim or your perpetrator shows up for treatment, and you try to alter, change, give them new meaning to their reality and relationship with self and other people, it's going to be like you're telling us that one and one is three, and that's crazy. What do you mean that I'm not at fault? I must have done something. I can't tell you how many clients I've come in that are victims, really the victims of the abuse, and say, well, God, Mike, I did a lot of stuff just in retaliation to yell back and to scream back at them. I'm just as bad as they are. Attempting to put themselves in that same position as the one that is the abuser. They're not that. They have exhibited verbally abusive behavior, maybe, in an attempt to live in that situation, like the spouse of the alcoholic who drinks and gets drunk, not a drunk herself or himself, just if you can't beat him, might as well join him. Or the sex addict spouse, or the any of those spouses that may do the same behavior that the addict does, but the motive behind the behavior is different, so they don't have that particular dysfunction, they don't have that particular disease, they are not that particular pathology. They're simply reacting and responding to that pathological relationship, that pathological behavior. But it's not about who they are. It's about something they engaged in so they could connect with this person more. So we don't treat the spouse for alcoholism. We treat the spouse for something else. Because in some cases, their behavior might look alcoholically in that they drink, and they drink to the point of doing and saying things that they wish they hadn't done, but removed back from the situation, they don't exhibit those behaviors at all. Not at all. So if we treat alcoholism, or if we treat perpetration, in this case perpetration, we would be prescribing the wrong treatment to someone that is also yelling back to defend against. See, even using the idea of defending against is coming from a perspective or a mindset of mutuality. Well, I have to defend. I have to be a part of. I have to engage in. I'll have an impact in that relationship by my defense. I'm reacting to, which is involves the idea of connection, which involves the idea or invites the idea of relationship. Whereas you'll never hear words like that coming out of the perpetrator. I worked with a family, and it's interesting doing family dynamics when you've got this going on. You've got to be strong or have a couple of strong people with you. And I had the family, we just restructured the family and said, okay, we're going to see what this family really looks like. And so the kid and mom said, where do you want Dad? Because he was the perpetrator. And so what they did was they got a chair and they put Dad up on the chair. And said, well, he's not up high enough. So they put a phone book on the chair too and put him on the phone book. And then Mom was under Dad, and so had Dad lean over and press onto Mom's shoulders. And then the kids were all underfoot under where Mom was. And so this is how the entire family agreed, because I asked them, and we took a picture, is this what you look like? We videotaped it. Is this what you look like? And everyone agreed at the end of the experience, yes, this is what it looks like. And then when we started to work with Dad, said, now how do you see this? So well, this is the way it should be. I'm not abusive to these people. They're crazy. They don't know what's going on. I just, you know, all they want is my money. They really don't care about anything. And he just began to rage more and more and more. And the kids continued to believe they must have done something. We must be agreed that something wrong with us. They began to take back all of their angers. And Mom just kind of laid over. So Mom, in many ways, was teaching the children how to respond to the dad and to believe that it was their fault and they must have done something wrong. And there's nothing really wrong with Father. We just have to be more loving ourselves. And so that family made some decisions along the way not to recover. A year later, one of the daughters, the youngest daughter, came into treatment, and she began to work with her alcoholism. But the big thing for her is the vulnerability. It's okay to look at a level on a surface, a facade, that says I'm going to do something, so she's not drinking. So all I tell what I know about drunks that just don't drink is they can just remember what they did the night before. That's the only value of not drinking and going to meetings in and of itself. It produces no change. It's just you can remember it. And so she's doing that, and that's at least a step in the right direction. But it's very difficult for her to be willing to do the T word, which is trust. It's very difficult for her to make a real conscious decision on her own. The other thing that happens in the dynamics of family treated drug abuse is that the perpetrators, the members of that family, have been discounted so often, so subtly, sometimes not so subtly, to believe, they've been brainwashed to believe that there is something wrong with them. And that's what she believes. She also believes, through being brought up in that system, that every time that she attempted to talk about how she felt, particularly to her father, she was discounted and ignored and pushed to the side and demeaned for having feelings. What's wrong with you? You're a wimp, you're a wuss. God, can't you get it together? So she doesn't have permission in her family to tell the truth about how she feels. So we've got major trust issues. And what I tell my clients with trust is that, number one, you have no trust issues with me. I'm not the enemy. And to prove it, what do? I do this, is what I do. I drop things and I look a fool and all that kind of stuff. And I fumble. And I show them my Sam's card or my driver's license or anything with a picture on it. And I say, this is who I am. I'm not those people. I'm not your father, uncle, mother, brother, cousin. I'm Michael Yeager. That's who I am. Now, you don't know me at all, so there's no possible way that you could have a trust issue with me. So I confront that trust issue. It has nothing to do with me, and I will not participate in that process of yours. I refuse to be your perpetrator, and I refuse to be your savior. I will simply be here doing my job. I'm called the counselor. And we don't know each other. But this process is going to involve us knowing each other. So you have to treat me as me. I show my driver's license again. This is who I am. And anytime you think that I'm not this person called Michael Yeager, I need you to tell me that you think that I'm somebody else. So now I challenge them to do what's called a pattern interrupt, to change that way of thinking that says, I am like this other person back here. Also, by putting out a challenge, what I want you to do gives them permission in a way they've never had permission before to acknowledge and then to take action on that acknowledgement that they notice something, that they're smart, that they can perceive, that their perceptions and their ideas count and are in fact meaningful. They do in fact have meaning and value. So I issue that challenge right up front to challenge the idea that what you say is worthless, you don't know what you're talking about, you must be stupid. I'm now saying, and without saying any of those words, that you have intelligence, that you have the ability to perceive, that you really do know what's going on, and that you really can be here for you if you're willing to do that, if you're willing to tell your truth, your perception of the truth. And that challenges that for the individual. What that does, again, is empower. Because what happens in the abuse is it disempowers the individual. Got a definition that I speed through. Oh, I don't know if y'all have seen this. The Houston Council on Alcoholism did this. Y'all heard of the family roles and all of that stuff? Houston Council came up with this. It's a cute little drawing. And I think counselors are always into cute. And so this is cute. And if you want a copy of this, leave me your name and number and I'll send you one. I don't think I included it in your packet. But it's the family roles. And the thing about roles is that everyone is scripted to those roles. And no one can move out of those roles. And it's not that healthy families don't have roles, but there is flexibility in the playing of those roles. I think roles are good, and I think every system has them, and they keep the system in alignment. But in a dysfunctional family, if anybody attempts to break out of that role, then it destroys or tends to destroy or at least negatively impact that system. And the system fights against the change. Well, it's important to know about rigidity in roles, particularly in a verbally abusive relationship, is that when the one that is the victim now says, I won't be your victim, now says, stop, I won't take that from you anymore. Now, most of the time, let me say this, that your victim's not going to be willing just to do that. You say, yeah, you know, I say, this is what I want you to do. The next time they start screaming, just put your hand out here and say, stop, I won't listen to that crap anymore. But most of them won't do that. And I say, that's fine, you don't have to do that. But would you be willing to very, very quietly and shyly, in a way that no one knows, because I really understand how afraid you are, is to write "stop" behind your head so that no one can see it. Or to write the word "stop" on a table so that no one can see it and then erase it very quick. Or to begin to spell out the word "stop" in your brain so that no one can see your thoughts at all. Put a shield up there so they can't see your thoughts. And put a shield up there and write the word "stop." In fact, just put parts of the word "S" down so that you really know that no one sees what you're doing. You break it down to the smallest component for that individual. What I've just done is given them a spectrum to go through. We started with this, the "stop," and then we went back to this here. And so that what they're going to do is then they're going to go inside themselves, which is where they need to be, and they're going to come up with a way that they can incorporate, that they can find, that they can do something to say, "stop." If the most they can do is just turn their head to the side just a little bit, and they've always had to look face on because you look at me when I talk to you, and they do that, maybe they don't have the strength to do this, but maybe they have the strength to look up just for a second, or to look down for a second, or to look around for a second, or to do something different. See, what we've just introduced at that point is what's called a pattern interrupt for the individual. That's a neurolinguistic programming idea. NLP, if you haven't studied it, it's a great technique.
Can I ask a quick question?
Sure.
I've been trying to find a book on that. I can't find a good book on that. Do you know
what NLP?
Yeah.
Frogs to Princess by Grandler and Bindler. Yeah. I can give you more information about that later, but that's one book. If you want, I've got a whole resource of that at home, or not at home, but that'd be one, Frogs to Princesses, as well as there's some great books just on NLP. I think Hazelton even has some books on NLP now. NLP, Neuro-Linguistic Programming. It's a combination of, they got the work from Virginia Satir in Family Systems Theory, from Eric Erickson in Hypnosis, and from those schools of thought is where this came from. And they really used it very effectively in sales, and they found that you can create excellent rapport with someone through using these techniques. They're great counseling techniques as well. But it's a way to, in this case, the pattern interrupt is to stop the pattern from occurring. Just to say stop, no, break the pattern in some way. If you want to break rapport with someone, it's a real simple process. Let's say, if any of you have been talking on the telephone with someone and you wanted to get off the phone and just couldn't shut them up and you didn't know how to say stop or to get away, just start tapping very lightly on the telephone. Very, very lightly. Not abusively at all. It will stop their train of thought. They'll come to closure and you'll find a way to say, I'm through. Or if you're talking to someone and you don't want to talk to them anymore, look down. Divert your attention somewhere else. Break eye contact. Or, if you want to gain someone's attention, make eye contact with them, but not in a way that you're staring at them. Make eye contact with them the same way they make eye contact with you. If you want them to be more involved in your communication, match their breathing. If you want to be more involved in communication with them, match their tone of voice. Mirror that back. And you know what? They'll think that you're just like them, and they'll pay attention to you. And if all you do is match and mirror behavior to your client, and you never open your mouth at all, they'll think they had one heck of a good session because you were there with them. You were there with them. Think about anybody that you've ever had a communication with. What did you get from them when you really felt communicated with? Was it what they said or how they engaged in that communication with you? And in verbal abuse, none of that's happening. That's why it feels crazy. It doesn't happen. There is no communication. There is no give and take and sharing. And so with the victim, you might attempt to work with some of these techniques to let the victim know that you really are there. You're really there. Maybe you don't know anything about verbal abuse or even how to help them. You don't have to. Just be with them. Be with them. Give them permission to find and to tell their truth and then validate their truth. I've learned a long time ago never to tell anybody that I know what that feels like, because the truth is I don't. I don't know what anybody's experience feels like. Even if I think I've walked the same path, it's a lie. I'm lying to that person. If I tell them, I know what that's like. I absolutely lie to them because I don't know what it's like. And so if you really want rapport, validate them. I don't know what that's like. Tell me about that. See, they believe that no one knows what it's like. So don't try to scam them and tell them something that you do know what it's like, because you don't. You really don't have any concept of what it's like for them. You have concept of what it's like for you, but you don't have any concept of what it's like for them. And this is their therapy. It's not yours. Their therapy is not yours. And so let them know. Validate their aloneness. They already feel it. You're not going to take it away. How many of you have ever felt alone and someone tried to take it away from you and you fought them for it? Damn it, that's my aloneness. You can't have that. You don't know how I feel. Well, you don't. So validate that reality for them. See, once you meet them and are in rapport, they have allowed and you have allowed connection to occur. And when connection has occurred and people are now in rapport with each other, then you can begin to move with each other in a process that will allow them to validate who they are and feel special and to validate their reality for themselves and know that you're there with them in that validation of reality. They're looking for mutuality. If you attempt to help them experience their uniqueness and also validate their experiences, they then can move and find resolution on their own. So when you finally tell them the solution for this is to no longer buy into the idea that you did a damn thing to cause this, that's like the stop. That's a very foreign idea to them to begin with, because they want mutuality. So mutuality in a verbally abusive relationship is understanding that they didn't do anything to cause it. And there's nothing they can do to stop it. Nothing they can do to stop it. And this isn't 12-step you're powerless stuff. It has nothing to do with that. It has to do with breaking and changing and altering a mindset, a way of believing. And that mutuality for a victim living with a perpetrator is that they can't do anything about it because they didn't do anything to start it. That's a revolutionary idea for victims. Absolutely revolutionary idea. It doesn't make sense to how they might not need to do family of origin work. They might not do anything else. Unless the words have been said, probably not, but there might be a threat of my life will be meaningless if you're not here. My life is wrapped up in you. But no, there tends not to be a physical threat if one hasn't been given. There's an emotional threat, since maybe that's where they got their meaning, was in that relationship or out of that relationship. But it's not generally the physical. No. There's going to be distrust probably in their ability to have and to maintain meaningful relationships, but there again, that concept or that idea that I didn't do anything to cause it, that the issue in verbal abuse is the verbal abuse. That's the issue. And that's really where you need to do your focus work, is that the issue is there's not going to be resolution in this relationship. It's not going to happen as long as the perpetrator is staying a perpetrator. If you're only working with the victim and you're not working with the perpetrator, you need to understand that anything they confront or talk or communicate with that perpetrator will not bring about resolution in the way that the victim wants resolution, which is, I want my relationship to work out. I want to keep this thing going. That's probably not going to be happening. So we don't need to say this relationship is going to continue on down this path and it's not going to work out, because I don't know the future. But what I can say is that this is what you've got, and you do some reality testing on exactly what has, in fact, occurred. I got a definition from Folsom and Mason in 1986 on shame-bound families. It's a good definition that I use with this because it deals with loss of sense of self. A shame-bound family is a family with a self-sustaining, multi-generational system of interaction with a cast of characters who are or were in their lifetime loyal to a set of rules and injections demanding control, perfection, blame, and denial. But the whole system that's in place for many, many years, this person has bought into that system, the perpetrator as well as the victim, and acts as if that will continue to be part of their reality and truth. When people move into a recovery mode, I got a little decision-making process that I took from Diamond Mountain, a treatment program in Dallas, Texas. They treat primarily sexual addiction. But in this decision-making process, I have, and I do this with victims as well as, well, anybody that comes in that seems to be conflicted in deciding to do something different, I have them write down their decision. What is that decision? Then I write, have them write down, what are three alternatives decisions that you could make at the same time? One is, let's say, to leave the person. Well, that's, okay, that's a decision. All right, I want to make the decision to leave the person. Well, another decision could be, I'll learn to live with it. The other decision could be, well, I'll learn not to have it affect me anymore. The other decision could be, well, I'll speak up to them every time and stay in a situation. So there's many different things that a person could do. You want to put out on the table or help them find ways to put out on the table all the different things that are available. They've been coming from a rigid perspective. They've been rigidly trying to find mutuality and co-creation with an individual who does not allow that to happen in relationship. The rigidity has been they won't tell the truth. They will not tell the truth about this relationship. So once they've got all these decisions down, have them write the pros and cons. That'll be another column to write down. What are the positives and what are the negatives for making this particular decision? So it's a written work process. Sometimes when people come into therapy, that's the first thing we do. After we do the initial interview and we talk for a while, I send them home with the form, and I say, now you tell me what you want from this session or from our involvement here. You go figure this out for yourself. Which empowers them with the idea that they have a mind, that they can use their mind, and they're in control of their lives. Something that I certainly believe of all of my clients. They're in absolute control of their lives. They are not powerless over anything. They are in control of their lives. And so I want to foster that idea. And so now we look at the family values, the other place we need to look. What did you learn in your family of origin about standing up for yourself? What did you learn in the family of origin about living with someone that's verbally abusive? What did you learn in your family of origin about leaving someone that's verbally abusive? What is the value that the family placed on any of those decisions or those actions? Because even if, I know a question all of you will respond yes to. How many of you have parents? Great, okay, all right, we can all do that. Now, how many of you that had parents didn't like some of the things that your parents said or did to you, and you swore you'd never do those when you grew up? Now, how many of you do same or similar? And how many of you that do same or similar wish you didn't and don't know how not to do it? Okay? So what we've got is we've got a set of behaviors that then we've got values around that we're scripted to do unless we break that script and roll and we have to experience some negative consequence. But we've got these values in place that define and drive us as people. And so we have to, when we make decisions, part of making a decision, particularly if it goes against what you learned in your family, besides changing the relationship that you're in now, you're going to change the relationship with you and your family. You're going to change that, and you will not be popular in your block. You will not be a popular person. You're going against what the family valued. You are a traitor. And I'm picking my words very carefully. Notice how I said you are a traitor. There's something wrong with you. Don't you know we gave you the best years of our life? Don't you know that we spent all that money on you? Don't you know that we loved you the very best way we could? Don't you know that we would have done it differently if we could have, but we didn't know any differently? They certainly are true. That's correct. And does any of that change or alter how you felt about it? So remember, this isn't about blame. It's about noticing how we learned to be in a relationship with self and others. It's also noticing that whether it could be changed or not, no matter how it was that you had feelings about it. And also noticing that if you feel differently about it and are going to go against your family system, no, that's not the truth. Excuse me. I said that on purpose. You're not going against your family system. You're attempting to construct a value system that works for you. Remember, this isn't against anybody else. It's for you. It's not that they're wrong and you're right, because they have justifications and reasons for doing it. Talk to a perpetrator of anything. Listen to them and ask for their statements that validate their behavior. I've never met a perpetrator that can't validate and justify their behavior. They'll give you that. It's right there. That's what motivates them. That's what drives them. So we're not saying that they're wrong and you're right, because this isn't about that. It's about making a decision about what you want now. And also helping you notice, helping the client notice that if in fact they go against the family value, that there will be consequences. And are you willing to pay that price? This is about personal assertion. This is about saying, I am more than that. I am greater than where I came from. I am whole and perfect just the way I am without these people, if that's what it has to be. And it doesn't make those people wrong or bad. It just makes those people those people. If you make a wrong or bad judgment on someone, they control you. That's what I've noticed. As long as I make judgments and am resentful over someone else, then they control me. I don't have any control at that point. They do. Attitudes, beliefs, old triggers control me as long as I make them wrong or bad. So this is about self-assertion. This is about acknowledging that self is powerful, that self can, in fact, overcome. And I'm not disparaging or putting out the whole idea of God or any of those other things. I'm talking about self and the power of the human being, the power that we have as people to make a different choice. See, certain choices were made based on all the information given to that child when they were growing up in that abusive system to believe certain concepts. They made certain choices. I hold people accountable that have hurt my clients. I said, we need to hold these people accountable for their actions. If you're going to recover, you need to hold yourself responsible for your response to those actions, how you took that in, a little bit of RAT in there. You see, if I'm responsible, if my client's responsible and owns responsibility for how they have responded to certain external stimuli that has no meaning in and of itself, it's all meaningless information. Verbal abuse in and of itself is meaningless. It's only abusive, or it only has a negative effect on someone if they allow it in. And I would suggest that if I was verbally abusive to all of you right now, if I said something grossly verbally abusive, some of you would take it in and say, oh yeah, maybe he is right. And some of you would say, this guy's a bozo. What the heck's he doing saying that to me? He has no right to do that. Get out of here, Jaeger. Some of you wouldn't take it in at all. You would simply disallow that information from having an impact on your life. So the information isn't the issue, it's what we do with it. But then you say, well, my gosh, Jaeger, these people were just children. They were just little kids. Well, haven't we known for a long time, Mr. Suzuki, number one, who teaches little kids about how to play violins, he teaches their master's violinist by the age of 7. Children are learning a long, long time before we give them credit for. Children have a lot more going for them than adults ever give them credit for, I have found. And so kids are making decisions about who they are. We've known in basic psychology that our basic self-concept and beliefs are set up by the age 3, that values are set by the age 10. We're making some decisions somewhere along the line. And maybe it's with that information, but we're still making the decisions. The individual is still making the decisions. We are powerful people from long before we get to the planet. We're powerful people when we get here. And like that message needs to be put across to people too. You see, if I'm responsible, let me say it like this. If the perpetrator is responsible for my problems today, now just think about this. This is the victim's way of thinking. If the perpetrator is responsible for my problems today, the only way that can be healed is I have to figure out some way to go 1 minute, 1 second before this perpetration or this abuse happens and stop it from occurring. If it is the cause of my problem. If it's the cause of my problem, I have to figure out a way, you have to figure out a way to take them back. And I'm not talking about regression.
I'm talking about in physical reality, taking back 1 second before that event occurred and stop it from happening. And I don't know if anybody's been able to figure out how to do that one. But what we can do with people to help them reinvent or relook at their lives is to, number one, get them into days in their adult mind. That's where they are. They're in their adult mind. And in their adult mind today, to look back at that situation and redecide, reevaluate that information. They said I was wrong or bad. I know differently today. I've got a whole library of books that have enlightened me to let me know that I wasn't wrong or bad, but my behavior of jumping over the table certainly wasn't appropriate at the time. So my behavior at that time wasn't helpful. It needed to be corrected or altered or changed. That would have been an appropriate parenting skill. But what I got instead was, notice this, the rational mind now talking, that what I got instead was that I was wrong and bad. And you know what? I believed it. I'm responsible for believing what they were selling. All that happened in reality, this is the truth statement, is that I jumped over the table. Mother, father, caretaker came in, started screaming and hollering at me and making all these noises. That's the only truth that happened. Any I messages that occurred, which go into shame, you're worthless, there's something wrong with you, negative core beliefs, are things that I created. They said them to me, I bought them. They hit me, I made it about me. They screamed at me, I made it about me. They told me I was stupid and would amount to nothing, I bought it. When people can come to that point, they understand their own power. See, when they can understand that, they really get that they're not a failure. They really get that they're an incredible, successful human being that's terribly powerful.
Have you ever had a perpetrator get well and then eventually somebody
another perpetrator? Sure. That's a standard systems issue, yeah. Family systems theory, or just that whole idea of systems, is that if someone changes in a system, if everybody else in that system isn't willing to engage in their own changes, they'll either leave or find someone else to be there. Yes. See, the victim, as long as he or she is in that mindset of victim, needs a perpetrator. And the perpetrator needs the victim. They work off each other. I hope so. I hope so. I do women's and men's different things just because that's what people want. But I believe that if what we're going to do is heal relationships, we've got to be in relationships to heal them. Got to bring men and women's groups together. I've seen some of the most powerful healing from abuse happen when I had a perpetrator and a victim in the same group. I put them together any time I can. Where the victim and the perpetrator are willing to be in the same group, I'm not going to force boundary violation, but I'm certainly going to promote it. I'm going to promote that you be in the same room with someone that did something to you. Now, this is Joe the perpetrator. This is Sam, your father, that did it to you. Joe's not Sam. Leave Sam the hell alone. Sam didn't do a damn thing to you. You're in group with Sam. Okay? Make the distinction. Set up the boundary. They don't know how to set up the boundary. We set up the boundary. Sam looks, acts, and smells like Dad. Great! What a powerful opportunity to heal. What a powerful opportunity to heal. So this isn't mine. This is Alice Miller's stuff. It's the idea that we live in the fear of some horrible atrocity is going to happen to us. And in reality, the most terrible atrocity can happen has already taken place. Has already taken place. There's nothing more tragic that can happen to you as an adult than happened to you when you were a child. So you have something now, right now, that a child doesn't have, and that's the ability to take your finger and to go to the telephone and go 911. You have the ability as an adult to rethink any situation that occurs in your life. You have the ability to ask for help. You have the ability to say to someone, if they're not giving you the help, I don't appreciate that about you, and I want this from you. Will you give that to me? And if you don't, I have the ability to get in my car and drive somewhere else and get it. How many kids do you know that can do that?
I don't know any kid that can do that. So that's why the traumas are more devastating in childhood than in adulthood. That's where all that comes from, it seems. So here, that's why it's so powerful as adults, and that's why I use the word power as it relates to people when I talk to them, is to confront their whole idea of powerless, I can't do anything, their boundaries have been violated, they don't feel that they can do anything about it. We also have to look at affirmations, and not at the affirmations like, you're a wonderful person, and the affirmations that I started to do with people, which is they write down all the negative self-talk that they gave themselves, do that on the left-hand side of a sheet of paper, and then do it on the right-hand side, the exact opposite. So it's not affirmations like, I am a child of God, I am a precious person, I am a worthwhile person. Those are good and those are helpful. But for the victim of verbal abuse, Patricia Evans has some better ones that fit the scenario here. And since he or she has believed and has affirmed that they said or did something in order to cause the abuse, and it was about them, not about the perpetrator, some of hers are, I feel hurt. I am being hurt. I feel unrecognized. I am being unrecognized. These are self-validating affirmations. She is, or he is telling the truth. I feel ignored. I am being ignored. That's telling the truth. I am feeling made fun of. I am being made fun of. So it's about acknowledging that this abuse is going on. It's about acknowledging that it's happening, and in that acknowledgement, we don't have to change history, and we don't have to feel less than. The power comes from telling the truth. The old biblical thing, I guess. The truth will set you free. And so in this case, the truth is setting them free. Oh, my perception of reality is accurate. Oh my gosh! Isn't that amazing? My perception of reality is accurate. I feel closed off. I am being closed off. I feel discounted. I am being discounted. Those are self-affirming statements that the victim is now making. See, because that's going to put them in a mode or in a position of vulnerability. They're not vulnerable when they say, well, I must have done it, or it's all my fault, or any of those things, because they're not confronting the perpetrator at that point. They're not confronting themselves at that point. They're not confronting anything at that point. Now, at least on an internal level, they're beginning to acknowledge it. Now, when it comes to time to confront the perpetrator later on down the line, that might be what they say. I feel discounted. I am being discounted. Now, they might be a parrot with that. So I do parrot therapy with people. And so I have them go home and talk them to the mirror and say, what are you telling yourself? And just tell yourself in the mirror, I feel discounted. I am being discounted. And I have them whisper it if they're very afraid. And then I have them say it louder. And I have them scream it. I have them find their power. I'm a believer in the mind and the body. There's a connection there. And I have them find their power in their body. Where is that? What has happened to the power in your body? And I have them locate it with their hands. And then I have them find the power and then press into the power and say these affirmation statements. Now they're getting a physical reality. They're getting in touch, creating a relationship, creating rapport with the body and the mind, and acknowledging that this truth is in fact going on and that they have feelings about what is being done to them. That they are worthy and value of acknowledging that they have feelings about what is being done, and that their perception, how they view, how they see that situation is in fact accurate because they make it so. Not because the perpetrator is going to make it so, because chances are they're not, but that they make it so. Remember the trust issue, the driver's license stuff? Now it's about acknowledging that they have made that so, this truth. I feel discounted. I am discounted. This is going on. This is, in fact, my reality. Now, they still haven't decided how they feel about it, and at this point, it doesn't matter how they feel about it. Right now, we're just noticing or helping them notice that this stuff is going on. We can't make a change in our life. We can't have a notice or an emotion until we acknowledge what's happening. I don't believe, because there's nothing to attach that emotion to. There's nothing to bring it to. And kids, along with when we're just little people, kids will just have a feeling just because they're having a feeling. They'll have an emotion just because they're having an emotion, just because that's what a little child is doing. They're happy for a while, sad for a while, hurt for a while, whatever for a while, and they haven't learned yet how to attach that feeling to something that's occurring. But as we grow up, we then learn through our feedback loop with people around us that we feel a certain way, or we believe we feel a certain way, and both of those things might be the truth, and notice I'm being general when I say that, that we have a feeling when that person says or does something, when this particular thing happens, and people begin to make connections. And that's in the natural growth process. And so now what we're asking this young child to do, called an adult, who is in the victim of verbal abuse, is to notice, to become aware of, to acknowledge that abuse is in fact occurring, and to validate that. I feel discounted. Not I feel bad, I feel good, I feel anything other than I feel discounted, I am being discounted. They're simply beginning to acknowledge that truth is in fact occurring and has in fact occurred, and that it's going on. So it's a validation of that reality. In time, as they integrate and come into their power and feel more of themselves, they'll notice that they have feelings about that particular experience. They have an emotional response to being discounted. See, they've always had an emotional response to the discount, to the abuse, to the words that were being said to them, but that was pushed out a long time ago. It wasn't allowed to show up. It simply wasn't allowed to come up. That's part of the brainwashing that occurred. They bought what this person was selling, that there's nothing wrong with me. I'm not being angry. What's wrong with you? You're just making up a story. God, get it together. You need a hospital? God, you're sick. Get out of here. And so they bought that after a while. And y'all know patients like that, don't you? And who have bought into all those things that people have been telling them. And even in 12-step for a long time, we make fun of the Al-Anon, saying, yeah, the alcoholic would tell her for years there's something wrong with you. Lo and behold, she began to believe him. She went off for treatment. Or he went off for treatment. And so we've kind of made fun of that for a long time, but they do begin to buy into that. And here again, we need to be broader in some ways than just this isolated relationship. We need to certainly focus on this relationship, but we also need to attach back to family history, I believe. Because in many ways, that's where it's going to be coming from. And that's where the early learning has, in fact, been occurring. Okay, some other parts of recovery after the individual has made a decision, and it is a conscious decision, because we have to go back into the family value. That's where I left off in the decision-making process. Look at the family value and see how the family value is going to be impacted by making this decision to recover. After we've looked at the family value and how that is impacted in this decision to recover, then have them write down what the final decision is. They look at all the information, all that they can gather at the time. Now what's the decision? And now what are the consequences of your decision? You're going to do this. Now what's going to happen as a result of that? And they plan that out and they know it, so there's not a surprise. That may not come out exactly that way, but at least they have the information. You didn't give them the information. They got it from themselves. They now are learning that they can rely on their thinking process, something that in the brainwashing of in that relationship, they learned that they couldn't do. You help them relearn that they can, in fact, rely on their thinking process. And when they make a decision, there's going to be a consequence, and they can decide if they're willing to pay that price or not. They may or may not be willing, and that's okay. It doesn't matter at that level or at that point that they make any decision, but it's important that they at least are aware, I believe, that when they make a decision, it'll cost them something, and are they willing to pay the price? That's their decision at that point. I'm not promoting or forcing anything. A way to help people after they've made that decision and they want to deal with family of origin or what they experience in their relationship that's abusive now and they want to go back in and tell that truth is to have them, it can be an open-eye experience or it can be a closed-eye experience, doesn't particularly matter. I have learned that if people trust themselves and if people trust your process and if people trust the environment that you created that's safe for them, that they'll do what you invite them to do. And it's not that you've done anything other than create safety. And I also have a firm belief over the years that people want to get well. People want to heal. Even when I make a joke that you pay me your hard-earned money and fight me all the way, that people do in fact want to heal. They want to get better. So you give them an opportunity, give them half a chance, and they'll probably respond. And so you invite them to go back and to take a trip, and this is about self-trust, to go back into a life shock or a life event that was hurtful to them. And have them speak as if it's happening right now. They're walking into the room. He just walked in the room. She just walked in the room. He's yelling at me, telling me I'm stupid. I'm hearing that I'm stupid, and they're right into the experience. He's telling me, she's teaching me, she's scolding me for doing my homework wrong, and put them right back into the experience. You want an abreaction from them is what you want, to go back into that experience. And people will respond to that if you've done that one thing, which is create safety. And if they've made a decision to heal. And they'll go back and experience that. And in the middle of that process, you want to stop them. And you want them to give you all the I messages that they're giving themselves. I'm bad. I'm worthless. I'm no good. If you're worthless and no good, what then? If you're really a scumbag, what does that say about you? What next? You want them to go deeper and deeper and deeper. We're going for core belief at this point. What's the depth of that core belief about your belief that you're worthless, no good, terrible, bad, whatever those I messages are, the shame-based messages? What are they? You're sitting there with them, you've created safety so they're not hurting themselves or other people. They're not be snotting on themselves, they're not be shaking, they're not be laying on the floor. You don't care, you want them to tell the truth. Remember, people want to get well? Remember, people really need to feel safe in order to tell the truth? All we're doing is creating safety for them to tell the truth. We're not discounting the idea that they're worthless and bad, miserable, scumbag human beings. We're just saying, sing me more. Tell me more of your truth. We're not trying to tell them, oh, no, that's not what you mean. We're not trying to take that away saying, oh, but you're much more than that. They don't care about that. They don't believe that anyway. We want their truth, not your truth. Your truth doesn't matter. Their truth does. What's the truth for them about them? But you're just writing down very fast the I messages. The value of that is now you have the truth exposed. Now it's exposed. You'll know that you've gotten to the bottom of their line, and this is what I find in everybody's case, or what I've noticed so far, is that they will die or something worse is going to happen to them. That seems to be people's bottom line. They'll die or something worse. And so once you get to that, you'll know that you've done that and bounced off the bottom, because the other stuff that comes up is pretty similar to what you heard over here. So when you get to the bottom, you stop the process. And then just let them just breathe in for a few seconds or whatever and calm down for a minute. And then you go back and you challenge, or you verify, would be a better word, verify what they have just told you. And in that verification, you read off, I am worthless. Is that true? Is that false? Or don't you know? And it's true that you're worthless if 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, you are in fact worthless. There's nothing worthwhile about you at all. And I say it back to them like that. And you know what most people do? Well, no, I'm not. Always worthless. I mean, I remember once back in 19, and I was worthwhile. Yeah, I'm not worthless. And they'll come back with something that will counter that belief and that idea, and they will make it false what they had believed to be true. They, not you, took it away from themselves. They restructured that belief. It's false. I mean, it's not false. It's don't know if it has to do with the future. I'll always be worthless. Well, we don't know about that. Are you a psychic? Are you psychotic? No. You always know. And people don't know, so you write down don't know. Once they've re-evaluated their perception of themselves, and you go down the entire list, I hand it to them. It's their information. They now see another sense of being involved, where they are now disputing their truth. Where they have come up with the really feeling belief that I'm worthless, but at another level they've really noticed that, no, I'm not worthless, but they've made a distinction that my behavior over here, or that a belief about me, or that something other than who I am may be worthless. But I am not worthless. And then you go back and you have them tell the truth about the experience they just re-experienced. who I talked about a minute ago, where you have them to tell me the truth about that event. Well, the event was that I was sitting there and the phone rang and I picked up the telephone and this person started screaming at me and calling me all these names and belittling me or raging at me as we were having a nice dinner. And they said, now tell me the truth about that event. The truth is, and if they're in a mode to recover, we'll say something like this. I picked up the telephone and said, hello, and they started screaming. That's the truth about the event. The I messages are stuff that they made up. I'm responsible, this is where that idea comes in, I'm responsible for my reaction to the abuse. If people can accept, because you've already given them an experience, not an intellectual opportunity, not a Kodak moment, but an experience where they experience the difference between that event and their thought process, it makes it easy for people now to buy into the idea that I need to hold them accountable for yelling, but I need to hold me accountable for making it about me and not about them. Yes.
How do you deal with a person that has a lot of cognitive distortion?
Well, at first I would try what I'm doing there and have them make those distinctions and to find out what is causing or what is the cause of the distortion. What do they get? What is the value of the distortion? If it's chemical, there is better living through chemistry and I send them off to a chemist. And then come back after that has been corrected. We go back and work on little bits to help them begin to see that they are not their behavior. If you, and I might even bring it into this present moment to help them make some distinctions between who they are and what they do, or who someone else is and what they did. And I would suggest that in every relationship that we can find in our lives, there's never one that is all bad. There's always some good. Let's say that they come from just a horribly abusive family situation and all they can see is the negative. And I say, well, go back and find me one good. Most of the time people get upset when I ask them to do that because that challenges their belief that it's all bad. And they go back in and they find one good, beginning to make some distinctions.
One of the things I've done is I've taught a 15 basic cognitive distortions that take place. I provide a brief education on that to them, giving them some examples each one so they can understand it. Then I give them a little handout and help them identify which distortion they feel they operate out of the most. And it helps them to see where their thinking really is. And, you know, using that particular education and that tool, how can we incorporate it into something like this?
That is delusion or denial, minimization, rationalization.
Projection.
Right.
Memorize.
Boundary statements of what's about you and what's about them. By their yelling, what does that say about you? Are you really bad, or were you just in the room? By your confronting them and saying you won't tolerate that, is that an abusive statement in and of itself, or is that a self-affirming statement? So have them go and answer that for themselves. Now, the response that you got from the perpetrator at that point was to hit, raise, holler even more. Based on your intent, was that an appropriate or an appropriate response? Well, no. Or sometimes, if they're too scared to do it about themselves, I have them do it third person. If that happened to another person, what would you believe about that? But take it away from them. Sometimes it's too close. Or sometimes I might even do an imagery where they put a shield in front of them and notice how they would perceive that. Or sometimes I'd use hypnosis and then go in a hypnotic state and work the subconscious mind to ask them to notice the difference between those two. What's about me? What's about them? If they don't know anything about boundaries, I just walk toward them and say, tell me when to stop. You know that trick, don't you? When should I stop? Okay? But now we know that they're not over here. Sometimes I can walk all the way over to here. Uh-huh. And so if we've got those kind of situations going on and they can't make that distinction, create some experiences right now in this moment. Because sometimes it is too hard to go away and to go back into the history. So if we want people to feel empowered, and that's really where I'm always coming from, is to empower people, is to show them right now what's theirs and what's mine.
and to help incorporate that. So I like the idea of your education with them, but then also to create an experience would also be helpful in the present moment, to help them see right now what's happening.
Do you have any handouts on that or different ideas?
The handouts are right there. I'm sorry. No, I'm not sorry. I regret that I didn't bring that material. It's rather subtle how we can get into those words. That's right. Absolutely. So, but no, I don't. That's the paper that I brought. I regret that. But so those are things that I would. When it comes time for the victim to confront the perpetrator, if that's going to happen, you need to be very clear about this. This is real key in their recovery. And that's whether you do... John Gray. What you feel, you can heal. I don't know if y'all have seen his books. Men are from Mars and women are from Venus. Men are okay and... we all know that, or something like that. No, that's it. That's the cognitive distortion. Anyway, so, in John's love letter, and I love John Gray's work, particularly his love letter. He has people write down in this letter form, and I do it with the grief work that I do, but also with this. He uses a statement at the beginning, and again, I'm a major believer in forgiveness. Let me give you John James' definition out of the Grief Recovery Handbook. Forgiveness is letting go of the idea or the possibility of a different or a better yesterday. Forgiveness is letting go of the idea or the possibility of a different or a better yesterday. So it's letting go, it's releasing. Letting go. So if people are going to heal, they have to let go. If people are going to stay sick, they're going to hold on too. Don't we know in the recovery game that we always tell people, kind of as a matter of course, like 90 meetings in 90 days, that you're as sick as your secrets? So we need to let go of the secret resentment. We need to let go of the secret shame. We need to let go of these secrets. We need to tell the truth. If we want to differentiate between us and our behavior, we need to help make that same differentiation between that person that hurt us and their behavior. That people are not their behavior. And so he starts the letter, "I'm writing this letter to release my resentment and negative emotions, and to discover and express the positive feelings that you deserve. I am writing this letter to ask for your support without demanding it." Now, your victim may never read this letter to the perpetrator. It's not necessary that he or she does that. If it was necessary that we have the perpetrator involved in our own personal recovery, then many, many people would not recover because some of those people are died or moved away. And reality is that what someone did to you has nothing to do with who you are. Nothing to do with who you are. You accepted, I tell my people this all the time, you accepted certain bits of information. That's your responsibility. They're accountable, you're responsible. Make the distinction in that process. And if they're going to talk to the perpetrator, we now have to alter, shift, change the mindset. It's not about mutuality and co-creation at this point. It's about telling the truth. I'm angry at you for. I'm hurt that you. I feel sad that you. And then tell them what they want. It's basically, I feel when you, because, related back to history somewhere, and then tell them specifically what you want. I feel when you, because I want. Notice I didn't say, you make me feel. It's, I feel. It's a personal ownership at that point. The power of that is that the person is now acknowledging that they feel whatever they feel, and it's okay that they feel it.
I feel discounted, and it's okay that I acknowledge that I feel discounted. I am being discounted. And they use I statements for themselves. That's powering. That's empowering. When they confront the perpetrator, it's never, well, I won't say never, chances of the perpetrator responding saying, hey, gee, shucks, I'm sorry about that, golly. Unless they say it in a demeaning way, and they say that and say, you really are a weak person. But it's about making the statement to the perpetrator, or if they're going to talk to them, with the intent of them telling the truth without an expectation that the perpetrator will respond in a positive, nurturing, understanding way. They must drop the expectation. Mutuality and co-creation, out of the window, let's just tell the truth. But if they're going to do this in the office or even with the letter, you write down what you're angry about. Anger is a great veneer. It protects us from a lot of things, and anger is not rage. Rage is never necessary. It's always inappropriate, and it's always a lie. I make those kind of statements about rage. It's never appropriate, and it's always a lie. It's always out of control, too, and it has nothing to do with the event. It has to do with your perception over time and the explosion within the individual and their perception, how they deal with it. So it's their mismanagement of that truth. It's my fault if I'm enraged. That's mine. It's not the other person's.
The mismanagement is the lie.
What?
The mismanagement is the lie.
But the rage is the lie and the mismanagement, too. There are other ways to handle it. I just learned what I learned. I could have learned different things, but this is what I learned. That's also, and the, what I learned is the truth. That's also part of the lie.
I'm having a hard time following rage is a lie.
Rage is a distortion of reality. You see, if I'm out of control, then number one, I have given you power and control over me, which is a lie. By not being control over my faculties and my being is also a lie, because I was given all the skills I need to be in control over who I am and my person and how I respond. I've been given all those skills. So by not activating and using those skills, that's part of the lie too. And so the truth is that I can in fact tell you that I'm angry, and I can do it in a way that acknowledges me and also acknowledges you. It differentiates between you and your behavior, and it's not about you, it's about your behavior. So then it's always in control. And it's never about you have to acknowledge or agree with me for what I say. I just am saying what is true for me. And it's simply my perception. Just my perception. Because just because I feel hurt, even if it's not their intent, number one, I have to acknowledge that I'm still hurt, even if it's not their intent. Yes, sir. Yes. That's correct. Yeah, I try to always do a couple stuff either in my office or in relationship with someone else where the perpetrator is instructed simply to listen. Now, the issue is that the perpetrator may sit there and play your silly, stupid game, and I said it that way on purpose. See, it's because it's not important at this point that the perpetrator acknowledge anything. The function now is that the victim then tells his or her truth. And that the intent isn't that the perpetrator hear or respond or change their behavior. The intent here is specifically for the victim to share the truth. That's what it's about, so they can feel their own sense of power at that point. If the perpetrator happens to heal from that, that's great. That's a side benefit. But that confrontation is not for the perpetrator to heal. The point of the confrontation is for the victim to tell the truth.
So you don't have them set up contracts for consequences? You see, I'm not going to ask, I'm not going to abuse anymore, and I'm putting up family. And if you do, let's agree on the consequences.
Right. That's the I feel when you're because I want, that kind of thing.
So you would do that? Maybe on first visit even?
Well, it depends. I would prearrange all of that with the victim. Maybe the victim's not willing or able to say, if you do this again, I'm going to move out or have you move out for 2 days. That's correct. What I'm trying to do right now is to make it so that the victim doesn't have the expectation that the perpetrator is going to respond in any particular way. See, that's been mutuality and co-creation. That's at this point what we're attempting to break that pattern about. Right now, it's not with the expectation that the perpetrator is going to do anything. In fact, I don't care what the perpetrator does. I care what the victim does at this point. What power, empowering statements are they willing to make to tell their truth? That's where we have to start. Okay? And so, I think my time is up. And so, but anyway, read Patricia's book. I've got a course on verbal abuse. Get that. And thank you very, very much. Sure. No, but if you get a card or something, I can mail them to you. $29.95. Okay, verbal abuse. You're welcome. Yes, Is she signing on the back? I was just on the field. I understand your question. That's all I think. Thank you for validating. That's all right. Okay. All right. You're welcome. Good. Okay.